You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMM-LP in Burlington, Vermont. Today is Monday, August 24th. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Vermont author Arnold Kozak. Founder of the Exquisite Mind Studio in Burlington, Arnold Kozak is a licensed psychologist doctorate in the state of Vermont, a faculty member of the psychology department at the University of Vermont, and a clinical instructor in the Department of Medicine at the University of Vermont. He has over 25 years of clinical practice, yoga, and meditation experience. He has practiced with several spiritual masters and teachers, including His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Swami Chidvilasananda, S.N. Goenka, and Larry Rosenberg. Arnold Kozak founded Exquisite Mind in 2001, an organization through which he conducts individual and group mindfulness-based psychotherapy, consults to corporations and sports professionals, and conducts continuing education workshops for healthcare professionals. When I spoke to Arnie earlier this summer, we discussed his book, Wild Chickens and Petty Tyrants, 108 Metaphors for Mindfulness. I started out by asking him to talk a little bit about the value of metaphor in our lives.
When we usually think of metaphors, we think of colorful metaphors or obvious metaphors, comparing things to sunsets and roses, but metaphors are actually very much embedded in our everyday language and very much embedded also in the way we think about the world. And when I teach mindfulness in a variety of different contexts, whether it's in psychotherapy or in a classroom context, the popular, or in some cases the only way to convey it, is through metaphor. I mean, how do you describe the mind other than in metaphorical terms? It's mm-hmm. this insubstantial entity, or process. You see, even that's a metaphor. Is it an entity or is it a process? And if you assume one or the other, there are different implications and entailments to that, which can have effect on how we see the world and
right.
whether we're happy or frustrated. Metaphors have been, I started studying metaphors when I was in graduate school, sort of indirectly. The book I was reading was not by a psychologist, but a philosopher and a linguist, George Lakoff, the linguist, and Mark Johnson, the philosopher.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've had a fascination and wrote one of my master's theses.
And what was the name of the book?
This is Metaphors We Live By, by Lakoff and Johnson, came out in 1980.
All right.
And they've subsequently wrote quite a bit about metaphor in everyday language and what they call conceptual metaphor, the metaphors that are actually part of the very fabric of the way we see the world and think about things.
Okay. And it's interesting because, to some extent, you'd sort of think about metaphor as being something that arose out of trying to put into words that which we experience. And the fact that we live and express through language. And yet, it sounds like it's what you're saying is it's sort of become the way we think as well, and not just the way we express.
Yes, in fact, it is there. And as I've been saying in some of my readings, we can only understand mind in terms of metaphors. And self, too, lots of popular metaphors, but maybe even the self, the notion of self itself might be a metaphor.
Yeah. It's hard to think about.
Yeah.
So, when did this book start to come together for you?
Well, to put a little bit of backstory, I started writing my book in 2002, and that was a book on mindfulness and perfectionism and a bit more of a scholarly, clinical type of book, which I'm still writing to this day. I sat down a couple of years ago collecting my notes on PowerPoint slides that I was using in my different classes, and I had bunches of little collections of metaphors, and I was just compiling them out of convenience, sitting around one day, and then the idea just came to me. It's like, wow, I could just create a little compendium of metaphors, you know, all the different metaphors, and just write a little brief chapter of each. And that seemed like an exciting idea, so I just sat down at my kitchen table and started writing these down, and I didn't know how many there would be. And I just finished reading Pema Chodron's Comfortable with Uncertainty, 108, forget the subtitle of that, but Reflections on Compassion or something. And I'm like, well, it could be 50, it could be 100. And as I started writing them down, I was like, it was almost like I was just doing translation or downloading all these things that had been in my mind informally in the process of, that I was accessing in the process of my teaching, sometimes generating these metaphors actually in the teaching or therapy process, or collecting them from various readings over the years and my own practice. So I was just writing it all down, and I pretty much in the span of a few days had compiled quite a about 75% of what eventually came became the book.
Were you just sort of bulleting them at that point and not really expanding on them?
No, I was actually, well, both, but I was actually writing them out, at least in rough form.
Wow.
And because of the structure of it as brief chapters, so it would be just providing the kind of catchy phrase for the metaphor, the image, talking about that, and then relating it to mindfulness and to practice. And then I came up with the idea, well, I could build this up to 108. And then for the next few weeks, I'd be surreptitiously writing notes, like in the middle of therapy sessions, like, oh, that's a good one, you know, I got to put that one in, and invented some new ones, and just remembered ones that have been circulating.
Well, it's funny,
because
having read it, I suddenly started noticing things that were like, that would be a metaphor, that's an interesting metaphor. So it makes you think in those terms, yeah.
Well, yes, everything, in a sense, almost everything is metaphorical, and a lot of them just are very much there in the background, taken for granted, but still may have influence on how we view things and how we experience things. Some people like Lakoff, his work now is looking at metaphors in politics, and really feels that they have a substantial effect on how people perceive things. But so they're definitely having influences, whether consciously or unconsciously.
Well, why don't you read one?
This is the first metaphor, and chosen to be the first because it is one of the primary. And this is one of the things that our brain does, our mind does. It has a narratizing function, and that we tend to tell stories. Now, a lot of teachers talk about this. I think the coinage storytelling mind is something that I started using, but here goes. Storytelling mind. Do you tend to think in words, often lengthy and unnecessary, and talk to yourself and others in the privacy of your mind? Of course you do. We all do. These conversations often form larger stories, patterns, and models of the world. It is as if there is an ongoing narrative to consciousness. The automatic thinking mind can get you into all sorts of trouble. This is what I call the storytelling mind. It is useful to make a distinction between the deliberate intentional mind and the storytelling mind. The deliberate intentional mind is practical and reality-based. The storytelling mind is impractical and often distorted or circular, often repeating itself ad nauseum. One of the favorite pastimes of the storytelling mind is jumping to conclusions. Here is an example of the storytelling mind in action that occurred during a meditation retreat that I led in the middle of an 8-week training sequence for a small group of physicians. The retreat was scheduled for both Saturday and Sunday. As far as I could tell, Saturday had gone well, with silent sitting and walking meditation throughout the day and a discussion period at the end. I arrived at my office early Sunday morning in anticipation of the group's arrival. A little while after the appointed starting time, no one had showed up. I was beginning to grow concerned, and my storytelling mind took wing. Oh no, they really must have hated yesterday because they didn't even call to say they weren't coming. I must have pushed everyone too hard and they've had enough of meditating, and so on. And so my thoughts went on and on and on. Then reality burst in, and my helpful mind spoke up and reminded me that I had yet to unlock the front door. I rushed out to find everyone happily conversing on the sidewalk in front of my office. Mindfulness practice will get you on intimate terms with your storytelling mind. Your storytelling mind will take you out of the present 99 times out of 100, and you'll frequently notice your storytelling mind during meditation. You'll be watching and feeling your breathing, and then all of a sudden you'll realize that you've been lost in thinking. When you recognize this, you come back to the breath. Dealing with the storytelling mind during meditation practice helps you to deal with everyday stresses and strains. By paying attention to how the mind goes into this particular form of distraction, you train yourself to notice it, and then you'll have the opportunity to come back. As a result, you'll be more engaged in the present and less lost in a mind full of stories.
Thank you. So that's the first metaphor in Arne Kozak's new book, Wild Chickens and Petty Tyrants. I say new book. When did this book come out?
April.
April. So it is new.
It still counts as new.
So when I saw Storytelling Mind, I thought, oh, this is perfect for writers. I'm going to read about Storytelling Mind, and it's going to help with writing. But in fact, it's a chatterbox state, and it's probably a distraction to the state where you want to be writing. And what do you think about that? Do you think that's true, or...?
Yeah, I think that what I call here, if you bifurcate the mind in this kind of simplistic way, there's the storytelling mind, which is the automatic, reactive, repetitive, distorted part, and then the synthetic, analytic, helpful, practical, adaptive mind, all of the higher brain functions and higher cognitive functions that we have. I think creativity is probably coming out of that space, mm-hmm. rather than the storytelling mind space. Sometimes people worry, if I start turning off my storytelling mind, am I going to lose all of my creative ideas? Am I going to lose all of my, you know, access to this creative space? And I suggest no. In fact, you should get less encumbered access to the parts of your mind where that creativity is going to be coming from, because sometimes what's coming out of the storytelling mind can actually be impairing or inhibiting the writing process.
Would you say that that's because what you're calling storytelling mind really sort of has a lot to do with ego?
Ego, definitely. Both building up ego and aggrandizing, and tearing down ego in terms of self-criticism and self-doubt and lack of confidence.
Right, like the story that you told within that. That was pretty funny.
Right, we always assume something wrong. I did something wrong.
And you did.
Locked the door, but it was the interpretation was off.
Right. Can you talk about how mindfulness might be helpful for a writer?
Well, as we writers are human, then mindfulness is very helpful. One of the benefits of mindfulness is just improved concentration. So an ability to direct our attention on a task and help to keep it there. And so we're building concentration so that we can read better, retain more information, and focus in writing better. I use sort of the model of a meditation retreat as a model for work. So at one meditation retreat, they had these, what they called sittings of strong determination, where you were sit for an hour without trying to, without moving, without trying not to move. And I can get very restless and fidgety and distracted, so I say, no, okay, I'm sitting down and I'm not getting up out of my seat for an hour, unless the house catches on fire. Right? I'm just going to sit and I'm going to work this. And that container in which to stay and do the work, and that can help push through some of the resistance that sits on the edge of, okay, I'm about to do some work and, there's a million other things, like, the house is never cleaner when you're
exactly
working on a manuscript,
because
there's always things to, important things to do.
Right. Laundry,
yeah.
Etc. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the structure of the book. You've separated the metaphors into five different categories: mind, self, and then there's one section called emotion, change, and ordinary craziness. The fourth section is acceptance, resistance, and space, and then finally practice.
Yeah. Well, as I compiled the metaphors, I started looking to see if there was some structure there, and this is a structure that seemed to emerge. Now, there's a fair amount of overlap, and the categories are somewhat arbitrary, because mind and self clearly overlap, and much of what the mind does is really part of our ordinary craziness, and the acceptance piece is sort of where we want to get to by recognizing all the metaphors for mind and self and our ordinary craziness. Then we can start to move towards acceptance and then practice kind of at the end to say, okay, here's, if we want to move forward with this, here are some helpful metaphors to help with your actual practice if you want to integrate mindfulness practice into your life. And then there's the appendix, which has some instructions on how to do practice.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So grouped together, for example, emotion change and ordinary craziness, how did those three, why did those end up all together?
As a psychotherapist, a lot of the sections, entries in that section on emotion change, and originally it was neurosis, my editor changed it to ordinary craziness, come from directly from my clinical work and metaphors that have emerged in working with people who are highly stressed or have depression or anxiety disorders and
okay.
other chronic pain and other conditions like that. So.
All right. And eventually you end up with practice. And you say at the beginning of the book that these can sort of be read out of order or mm-hmm. in order, or people can kind of take them as they like to take them. But
right.
The way that you structured the book, it sounds like once you get to the point of acceptance, then it becomes a regular practice activity. Is that why you ended with practice?
Well, I mean, I could have integrated them throughout the book. And again, the distinctions are a little artificial
uh-huh.
in that anytime if you... any moment where you're thinking about mindfulness implies acceptance, because that's what it is. We're in contact with the reality of what's happening in the present moment, and we're not telling a story about how we'd like it to be different. So if we are actually in contact with that moment,
right,
fully open to it, then we are in acceptance. So again, those are, they're somewhat arbitrary, but those images are more explicitly about or images or stories about acceptance and how to come to that.
Okay.
So, but it's really, they're all together. So people, you know, one way that you can read it straight through and then read it selectively, or just read it little bits here and there. And people have been telling me they just pick it up and they'll find something relevant or useful to what's going on for them right at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another way to use it.
Okay. Let's read another one. There's one called The Me Movie.
Mm-hmm.
Wondering if we could look at that.
The Me Movie. Did you ever notice that the mind makes life into a movie? As Larry Rosenberg pointed out in a meditation retreat I was attending, this is the movie about me, starring me, directed by me, produced by me, featuring soundtrack by me, casting by me, screenplay by me, and critiqued and reviewed by me. The mind is the original amateur auteur. What's more, there is usually plenty of drama and melodrama in this feature film, and as the title reflects, a great deal of self-preoccupation. When we live the movie in the first person, we are lost in the mind and not being mindful. When we are able to recognize and watch the movie from some distance away, then we bring mindfulness to life. The film itself, and the wonderful and alluring illusion it creates, is also a metaphor for the self. When you watch a movie, you see fluid, uninterrupted motion, but it is, of course, just rapid succession of still images. The continuity and fluidity is an illusion courtesy of the nervous system and its sensory apparatus. Likewise, you experience a solid, continuous self. This continuity and solidity is an illusion. Consciousness somehow fills in the gaps and asserts a continuity of self that neuroscientists and Buddhists for millennia say is not there. Mindfulness practice can help you to identify the elements of this movie and offers the opportunity not to take the self so seriously. Practice helps you to locate gaps in the continuity and to appreciate that this fluidity is an illusion, often a very pleasant one, but still an illusion. You can see in between the individual frames of the film, as it were, and get closer to the dynamic, ever-changing reality of your true being, your true self.
Thank you. That was Arnie Kozak reading from Wild Chickens and Petty Tyrants, which I should mention is published by Wisdom Publishing. So this seemed particularly apt for writers when I read about the Me Movie. It seemed like a good one for writers to think about. So often we're trying to work on the craft of writing, and a little voice will come in and say, you know, it's really good, I did a good job there, this is going to get published, I'm going to be famous, or I hate this.
Right.
But the Me Movie kind of focuses on the me, and I think that that can be very much of an interruption to the creative act.
All of that is fantasy, of course. All the good stuff, all the negative stuff, these are just interpretations that the mind makes, and it really takes us out of the present. What writing actually happens in the present, we're putting pen to paper, and that's where it's happening. So all these other thoughts, it's not that we want to suppress those thoughts. I mean, and fantasies of success might be helpful in terms of fostering a sense of confidence and providing some energy for the work, but it puts us into this territory, and this is a theme that's touched on a lot in the book, kind of these contingencies. If things are going great, I'm great, I'm okay. If they're not, I'm terrible, I'm awful. It's a contingent self, and we're very out of control because we're dependent on circumstances that are outside of ourselves that we may not be able to control directly, or even if it's based on our internal milieu, it's still, we're just getting bounced around instead of kind of having ourself be sort of, okay, here's myself, it's okay, not perfect. And then there are all these things that go around, but I'm not gonna necessarily believe this story or this movie that says, oh, I'm so wonderful. Unless you can really just believe that and not believe the opposite, right? If you can say, okay, yeah, I'm just going to go for the wonderful story and I'm going to dismiss the terrible story, then that's okay, because then that can help you perhaps have the energy and to persist and
motivate.
Yeah, but usually if it's one, it's the other. We're at risk for that the awful story about how terrible and lousy and miserable,
which is terribly inhibiting as well.
Yeah, and, you know, why did I ever decide to become a writer? You know,
right. So, recently, a friend and I were discussing meditation, trying to decide if losing yourself in your writing is a form of meditation or not.
Mm-hmm.
Because it feels like a meditation, but you know, because you can emerge an hour later having really lost track of time. But you definitely got words going on in your mm-hmm. head, and the mind is absolutely engaged
mm-hmm.
And not focused on nothingness or breathing.
Mm-hmm.
So is it meditation, or what would you say?
Yes, I would say it's meditation, it's mindfulness. I mean, if we think about mindfulness as paying attention, giving our full attention to whatever's happening in the present. So that could be writing, that could be reading, that could be washing dishes, that could be driving your car, anything, eating, anything we give our full attention to. So when we get absorbed into something, that's a natural form of, native form of mindfulness that all of us experience, have something that naturally draws us in. When we think about formal practice, then we think about how to develop the capacity to access that state anytime, or to help keep us in that state if we're not in that state. Natalie Goldberg, in Writing Down the Bones, talks a lot about writing as meditation practice,
uh-huh.
and that can be a formal type of meditation practice. So absolutely. I would encourage writers to do formal meditation practice in addition to that, because I think the more you practice it in a formal way, whether sitting or walking or doing that, but devoting time to, I'm just going to be working with my mind or my experience, the more likely you will be to fall into that space when you're writing.
When you sit down and try to access yeah. the creative mind.
Even when you're not, quote-unquote, just in the right space for that, you know, it can help make that more accessible.
Okay, great. Appendix number 3 in the book is called Walking Meditation.
Well, the prototype, when we think of meditation, we think of sitting cross-legged and on the floor on a cushion. And that's certainly one of the ways to meditate, but really we can think of meditating in any posture. Actually, the Buddha talked about is sitting, walking, lying down, and standing as the four options we have. So I always teach walking meditation to my students, because a lot of our life is spent in movement, so it can help us to get accustomed to being mindful in a movement context. It also provides opportunities for people to practice, you know, lead very busy lives and say, oh, I can't I can't take 20 minutes or 40 minutes to go sit on a cushion somewhere. I'm too busy. Well, are you walking? Okay, so when you walk from your car to your office, that's going to be designated practice time. And you're just walking. You're paying attention to the experience of walking, so you're not thinking about your day. You're not reviewing your conversation with your husband or whatever has happened in the past. You're actually just with that experience of walking. Or if you're walking for exercise, even better, you're getting your exercise and you're using all or some portion of that walking to do the practice, to train your mind. And there are formal walking practices where you actually practice, just you're not ambulating anywhere to get to a destination. You're not getting exercise, you're doing slow walking to develop awareness. And I teach, you know, you can do that at various speeds, very slow down, and then use that awareness then at real speeds in doing natural normal walking. It's also a very helpful practice to have in any situation where you might be stuck waiting, waiting for a bus, waiting for somebody to arrive, and then just instead of being bored or agitated, just do walking practice. Just walk at a relatively good pace. If you walk too slowly, it attracts a lot of attention to yourself. But just walk, and so it's a way of integrating practice more into life.
Yeah. It was interesting to me when I read about walking meditation, because in interviewing writers about their work, a lot of times they will talk about going for a walk as a way to regenerate when they're feeling stuck. When I go for a walk, I very often will listen to a book on tape, or will listen to an interview that I've wanted to catch up on with an iPod. But it seemed to me later that that's a missed opportunity, you know. And reading about mindfulness, walking meditation, made me feel like, wow, you know, I'm missing the opportunity to really use this as a meditative state.
Well, that opportunity is there, you know. Well, and it's in competition with other things as well.
Right. But we do fill our mind with all kinds of noise, I think. Maybe it's better for our writing to let it be a little bit freed up from that sometimes.
Well, you could give it a try.
Give it a try. See how that goes. I wonder if you would please read number 40, Deprivation Mind.
The meditation teacher Ram Dass uses the term deprivation model, and I'd like to offer a slight variation, the deprivation mind. The deprivation mind is a particular version of the storytelling mind. The deprivation mind is always looking at the world and saying, quote, I don't have enough, unquote. Whether it be enough love, sex, money, comfort, ease, recognition, validation, understanding, security, or any of a host of similar such things, the deprivation mind is especially prone to catastrophizing about a future that won't have enough of whatever the mind is preoccupied with, or a future in which whatever it does have is lost. The deprivation mind can be a subtle yet pervasively destructive force in life. Deprivation mind can also contribute to case building for the fact that you are deficient or defective in some way. Of course, it's the case that if you are inundated with the internal or external message that you don't have enough, you can easily come to believe there is something wrong with you and that having more of something would fix you. And you can thank Madison Avenue and our consumer culture for some of this. Cartoon in the New Yorker, published after the start of the Iraq War, shows an Iraqi man standing on a bomb-strewn ground wearing a, quote, I love USA, end quote, t-shirt. Over the caption, liberated Iraqi, this man is having the following thoughts. Am I losing my hair? Am I gaining too much weight? Is my breath okay? Are my teeth white enough? Do I need a new car? Is my deodorant letting me down? This is the deprivation mind in action. And yet, everything is of the nature to change. This is the truth of impermanence. But impermanence need not be deprivation. When you can mindfully sit and actually be present to and experience the changing nature of life moment by moment, you can start to see the practical wisdom of not trying to grasp after things and not trying to push things away. Mindfulness practice will help acquaint you with your deprivation mind and its cousins, deficiency mind and defective mind. It will show you the places where your storytelling mind is actively complaining about what it thinks it does not have in sufficient quantity, or what is wrong with you or your life. By exchanging the habit of complaining with the habit of mindful attention, you can move away from the quote-unquote ordinary craziness of these models and closer towards exceptions and satisfaction.
Thanks. So that was deprivation mind, and I thought that was another great one for writers, because writers' goals, I think, tend to shift with their various levels of success.
Yeah.
You know, I just want to write, I want to publish, I want to make a lot of money, I want to be famous, you know, these. I want to write my next book, I want my next book to publish. There's always that next goal, which is probably a good thing, but deprivation mind seemed almost to speak to this insatiable need for more.
Right.
Rather than accepting, you know, the goals already met.
Right. And it's good to have goals and to continue the work, but it would also be nice to be able to enjoy our accomplishments.
Absolutely.
I find the deprivation mind is also active. Like if I'm planning to sit and write and it's really sunny outside and it's like, oh, you know, it's as if like I'm really missing out and I'm being ridiculed for that. It's nice and I want to go play golf or do something else, then the deprivation mind complains about that.
Right.
And so it can lose sight of what's most important too, because it's responding to, you know, some of these culturally instantiated images of what we should be doing.
Yeah,
and
right.
So,
although I will say this summer in Vermont, maybe you should listen to deprivation mind if it's a sunny day. In the book, you have appendix number 5, informal practice. I wondered if we could just, we don't need to read it, but maybe just talk about informal practice a little bit.
Right. Well, the distinction between formal practice and informal practice, we touched on a little bit earlier. So formal practice would be, okay, I'm doing meditation now in whatever different forms, walking, standing, sitting. And that's my primary agenda for this next period of time. But that isn't really the goal here. I mean, the goal is so that we can have that sort of awareness and presentness in the rest of our life. So all of the activities that we do in the course of the day can become informal practice. And we're always doing something. So we're walking, we're talking. Talking is the toughest form of informal practice, to be able to be mindful when we're in communication. But we can practice with washing the dishes, eating our food, driving the car, all of taking a shower, everything that we do during the course of the day, we can practice paying attention, giving that full attention, or more attention than we usually do, because a lot of these activities are very highly learned and that we can do them unconsciously, automatically. Now that's very adaptive in many ways, but it frees our mind up to just go into fantasy land and storytelling mind takes over. So we're planning our day, or we're reviewing the past, or we're just commentating about what's happening, and we're not actually paying attention. We're on automatic pilot, in a sense. So those are opportunities when we can just see what's actually going on and pay attention to the input from our senses, giving that preference to following the stories in our mind.
Right, or obsessing over something that's been bothering us or
right.
Whatever. Okay, thanks. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what writers and teachers have influenced you.
Well, there are many writers and teachers. Larry Rosenberg, the studies that I've done with him, there's a lot of his metaphors that I've included in the book.
And did you send him one of your books?
Yes, and he's written a little blurb for it. It's not in the book, but it got too late for the publication, but it's on the website.
Oh, okay.
And he's been one of my teachers, and so a lot of his images are very good, and he tells a lot of stories and a lot of humor in his style of teaching. Jon Kabat-Zinn, of course, is inspiration to all of us doing mindfulness-based work in his writing and teaching. And so there's my meditation path, which has been influenced by Dalai Lama and other teachers. And then more in terms of writing, David White, I'd have to say, is my primary inspiration, and both his poetry and his his prose.
Okay.
On the working life, and have been a big inspiration. I quote him quite a bit in my teaching of things when I teach mindfulness courses. So those are, yeah, some of my bigger influences.
What are you reading now?
Well, apropos of David White, I just got finished reading his new book, The Three Marriages.
Okay.
Which is, he's talking about a conversation between the marriage of work, self, and relationship.
All right. I'm sorry to say I'm not familiar with him. So he writes nonfiction and poetry, is that?
He is a poet who, while in the context of giving poetry readings, was approached by a Boeing executive some years ago and saying, you've got to come speak to us. We don't have a language or vocabulary to deal with these things, and we need to deal with these things. And so he started going into corporations, giving corporate readings in corporate settings, and then became this kind of inspirational corporate consultant. And
okay.
He's written three books, The Heart Aroused, The Search for Soul in Corporate America, or The Resurrection of Soul in Corporate America, and then Crossing the Unknown Sea. And then his latest is The Three Marriages.
Okay. So you finished reading that one.
Yeah. And Steven Pinker is also, I'm a big fan of his, brilliant writer, just prodigious writer. And his latest book, The Stuff of Thought, also has a section on metaphor, so I was very interested in that. And just stuff on the everyday influence of language and things like our names and profanity and why we do the things that we do with language. So that was really fascinating. The other book I am reading is Saltwater Buddha by a fellow wisdom author, Jamal Yogis.
Uh-huh.
Saltwater Buddha is a memoir of his pursuit of meditation and Buddhism in the context of surfing.
Oh, wow.
And it's just beautifully written and full of great ocean metaphors and wave metaphors. And so that I've enjoyed reading that quite a bit.
Saltwater Buddha.
Saltwater Buddha, yeah.
Where does he live?
He's in San Fran.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Are you writing another book right now? You said you're working on your academic...
Yeah, well... in principle, but I actually haven't done any work on that. I did write a second book that's in a first draft form, taking the same kind of format and approach, but applying it in a sporting context, specifically for golfers. So I wrote Swing Like You Don't Care, 54 Golf Axioms, Maxims, and Metaphors. So that is written in search of a publishing outlet. I've been collecting in kind of bullet point form metaphors for a second volume of Wild Chickens, and I've got about 100 metaphors collected already. So that's one of the next potential projects. I need to talk to my editor at Wisdom and see what if there's some interest there. And I also have a number of other ideas and projects in mind. This this format, I think, is a very approachable format, so one that would be specifically focused on metaphors for the workplace, metaphors for psychotherapists, and more in a clinical context. But I have, you know, those. I did get a request, and I have some interest, although not much time at the moment, to write a book on helping dog owners cope with the death of their first dog or dog. So it's I've sort of started to outline the book on grief, attachment, the specialness of animals and dogs in particular, and what they have to teach us about grief and our humanness. And, and there's quite a bit of literature out there on that, and I would kind of bring in the mindfulness perspective to that.
I think that would be a good one. Very, very valuable to people. I wonder if you could read one more. And it's one of the title metaphors, Wild Chickens.
Okay. Once again, meditation teacher Larry Rosenberg tells a story how after many years of studying as a Zen monk in Korea and Japan, he went to Thailand to study in the Thai forest tradition of Theravada Buddhism. he brought with him on this journey a set of expectations and images of what the experience would be like. When he arrived, he was assigned to a small hut in the forest with meals brought by an attendant at regular intervals. It was the ideal situation for furthering his meditation studies. Ideal, except that the forest was also crawling with wild chickens, whose primary occupation was running around squawking all day. Distressed and dismayed, he was confronted with his own mind and stories. "How can I meditate with all this noise?" he wondered. "This is ruining my experience." As it turns out, one of my neighbors is raising guinea hens. While not wild chickens, they wander freely and make quite a racket, raising a cacophonous, bellicose screech every time my 100-pound Rhodesian Ridgeback and I run by. I'm delighted, my very own wild chickens. We always have a choice. If the reality of the situation contains wild, noisy chickens, it can be resisted or accepted. We can be distressed and agitated or at peace. Chances are that whenever you meditate, you'll have plenty of wild chickens to deal with. These include impatience, restlessness, boredom, and frustration. If you can set aside your ideas about how meditation or your life as a whole, or by extension, writing, if you can set aside your ideas about how things should be, you'll be moving closer to acceptance. And who knows, maybe you'll come to equanimously appreciate the company of all those wild chickens.
Thank you very much. I thought that was a great one for writers.
To the extent that we have limitations or conditions on how I can write if, again, there are these contingencies there. If I'm in the right mood, if I feel expansive, if I feel creative, if I, you know, have gotten enough rest, if it's quiet, if it's sunny, if it's not sunny, whatever these conditions are, then we're limiting ourselves because it's hard, probably hard to make those conditions.
Absolutely.
Materialize.
Yeah.
So there's always going to be some sort of wild chicken, some unwanted or unexpected thing happening. Whether it's coming from the external environment or the internal environment. So we devote quite a bit of energy resisting those, complaining, wishing things to be different, and then letting that get in the way. But if we can accept it, we can create a sense of spaciousness around that to include the wild chickens. Then they may be less of an encumbrance. They just become part of the landscape of this moment, which in fact they are. Which we just have been having trouble accepting that.
Exactly. It's just life. It's everywhere.
Yeah.
My last question for writers is what advice you might have for other writers who occasionally get stuck in their work or have trouble moving forward?
Well, I certainly have firsthand experience with this. But the stuckness, we can think about stuckness or writer's block, they're metaphors. Right?
Yes. They're,
and so we can reflect on the metaphors we're using, and we can maybe try to think of alternative images to guide that. For instance, I was thinking about, you know, at one point I felt like I had too much on my plate, and I was being pulled in all these different directions, and I was feeling fragmented. And so that was kind of the prevailing metaphor. But then I stepped back and said, well, what's necessary, what's not necessary here, and I like shifted that into an image of, okay, what if each of these is a strand and I'm weaving these together into this cord?
Mm-hmm.
And so that helped me to move from fragmentation to coherence.
Mm-hmm.
And then everything seemed to be contributing in a meaningful way to what I was doing rather than things being at odds and competing with one another. So we can look at the metaphors. But the resistance itself, or the stuckness itself, well, what is that? Well, there's a story, there's a narrative to that. So we can become aware of what are the complaints in my mind, and what are my reasons, supposedly, for being stuck. And we can do a little bit of mindfulness practice around that. So we disengage from that narrative, because that's just kind of fueling things. And then we look and see, okay, well, let me explore in a kind of phenomenological way what's happening now, what do I feel, and investigate the body. So how does the writer's block live in your body?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And investigate that. Spend some time breathing with that, or just noticing the energy sensations that are in our body at that moment. And not try to change it, not try to get rid of it, but just be curious and interested in it. and then see if we can move forward, leaning into that moment. Now, if we can accommodate the feelings of discomfort or imperfectness of that writing moment, then we're more likely to be able to move forward. But, you know, oftentimes the resistance comes in, it might come in, you know, what Julie Cameron or Natalie Goldberg call the censor, being overly active. And that's all part of the storytelling mind. So if we can recognize that, we have to see, okay, I'm just not writing because, you know, my mind is telling me, well, I'm not in the right place, or I'm just going to produce junk, or whatever these reasons are. Most of them are probably fairly flimsy if they're really examined closely.
Mm-hmm.
If we can really examine them closely. But oftentimes we're just allowing ourselves to be pushed around by our moods, emotions, our thoughts, some of which are really not obvious. They're operating in the background.
Mm-hmm.
So bringing awareness to it, and doing that exercise I suggested earlier, is like, plant yourself in the seat for an hour, and don't get up until you're done.
Right.
Now you could do like Jack Torrance did in the Shining. All work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. But Natalie Goldberg says, you know, just keep writing. You know, that's the writing practice. She says, in Writing Down the Bones, like, just keep the pen moving. Don't let the censor take over.
Yeah.
Just don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good, obviously, is sometimes very helpful.
Right. And I like what you're saying about the awareness, because I think sometimes awareness of writer's block will make us frustrated and make us give up. But in this case, it's almost like using the awareness as a weapon against writer's block and saying, okay, I accept this is happening right now, and I'm going to think about it, and you would just say lean into it in a way.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds like...
Right, that's one of the metaphors in the book, too. Lean into the sharp points,
right.
You know, because our tendency is, well, I want to avoid that. I don't want to look at the places that are uncomfortable or scary. But a lot of mindfulness is not just about being more blissful. It's about, okay, you know, really noticing how uncomfortable life is in this moment, and in conjunction simultaneously with acceptance, right? And so these things don't have to become obstacles. They're just features of the landscape,
mm-hmm.
rather than things to avoid or to have to deal with. They're just there.
Great. Well, thank you very much for talking with me.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Arnold Kozak. Please listen again next Monday, when my guest will be Vivian Dorsal, editor of the literary journal Upstreet. Write the Book is brought to you in part by Autism Support Daily, Vermont's first online support group and host of the annual Autism Walk each October at Battery Park. More information is available at autismsupportdaily.com or 802-985-8773. And by the Lake Champlain Regional Chamber of Commerce, promoting and supporting a healthy environment that makes Burlington the ideal place to live, work, visit, and do business, located at 60 Main Street in Burlington and online at vermont.org. And by Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility, building a brand new economy with old-fashioned values. Learn more at vbsr.org. And by Burlington Telecom, providing Burlington with access to the world. Internet, television, telephone, burlingtontelecom.com, Burlington's fiber optic network. Here's the Bookworm's calendar for the coming week. Mathis Levy, author of Earthquakes, Volcanoes, and Tsunamis, discusses natural disasters with young readers and their parents on Friday, August 28th at 5 p.m. at Borders in Burlington. Nancy Rubin Stewart discusses the subject of her book, The Muse of the Revolution, The Secret Pen of Mercy Otis Warren, before a group walk on Baldwin Trail, Saturday, August 29th at 1 p.m. at Mount Independence State Historic Site in Orwell. More information is available at 802-948-2000. In his role as keynote speaker for Montpelier Village Building Convergence, Radical Simplicity author Jim Merkel will speak on Sunday, August 30th at Lamb Abbey in Montpelier. More information is available at 802-454-1167. Today's Write the Book prompt was inspired by the interview you heard today with Arnold Kozak. The 30th metaphor for mindfulness in his book Wild Chickens and Petty Tyrants begins this way. In many Buddhist works, the mind and the self are often compared to a small pool of water. Thoughts can be seen as a breeze or wind blowing on the surface. These disturbances obscure what can be seen below the surface, the bottom of the pool, the ground of being, without changing it in any way. This ground is there, always there, no matter what is happening on the surface. Today's writing prompt turns that metaphor to your work. Consider the piece that you're now working on. Maybe it's a novel, a memoir, a collection of stories, or poetry. Perhaps it's a smaller entity, an essay or a story or poem, as opposed to a collection. The work itself has an underlying essence apart from the various images, snippets of dialogue, and actual scenes that exist within. As you write, try to keep a sense of this underlying essence within your work, your vision for it as a whole. Imagine that to be the bottom of the pool. Then, as you work and as you lose yourself in the wonderful creative act, feel free to make ripples along the top of the pool, to experiment and change and play with various elements within the work, all the while keeping clear in your own mind the bottom of that pool. Maintain this focus so that your work continues to embody that underlying vision, your writer's ground of being that is the bottom of the pool. A copy of this prompt will be included in the description to this week's podcast. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3 p.m. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. If you have comments about the show or events for next week's Bookworms calendar, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And now stay tuned. Cheryl Willoughby is up at 3 o'clock with the world of music. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP in Burlington, Vermont.